Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And okay, everybody, you're frustrated, maybe even horrified by what's going on in politics. So how many of you are therefore planning a political career for yourself to bring positive change to your community? I don't see many hands. And my next guest says this may be an issue for many years to come. In light of her research with students at some of the country's most elite institutions that have historically produced graduates who pursue careers in state or federal elected positions. Shauna Chalmers, an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers Camden, found that while many of these students want to improve their communities, they don't view careers in politics as the most effective and attractive approach to doing so. Shauna Chalmers wrote about her findings in her new book, Out of the Running, Why Millennials Reject Political Careers and Why It Matters, and she joins me now. Professor Chalmers, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners figuring out your career choices, tell us if you are considering something political, if you recently rejected that idea, why was that, or maybe this has changed for you since the election. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And I see that for your research, you spoke to 750 law and policy school students from Harvard Law, Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and Boston's Suffolk University Law School. Can you discuss briefly the history of these schools producing state and federal politicians?
Sure, absolutely. I chose these schools specifically because these are the ones that send the most of their graduates into national level office, and that's the two Harvard schools, Harvard Law and the Kennedy School. Kind of far outpace any other university for sending graduates into federally elected office. And then I looked for the school that sends the school within the state that I was in, Massachusetts, that sends the most of its graduates into state level politics, and that was Suffolk Law School. So I recruited this sample deliberately, as we say in the social sciences, as a hard test. I thought these would be the students most likely to kind of already be thinking that way because they're here at these political feeder institutions.
But?
Well, but it turns out they had some really good reasons for, in fact, they had thought that way, a lot of them. A lot of them had kind of considered the idea of running for office. And in fact, more than half of them told me in either the survey or the interviews that they had been told, somebody had said, boy, you should really be president or you should run for office, right? But they had generally rejected it for what I thought were some pretty good reasons. And that's what I spend most of the book developing, is this kind of cost versus benefits reward framework.
And 86% of the millennials in your survey said making their community better is a life goal. So this isn't a disinterest in community quality of life, but what, more of a lack of confidence in our political system?
Sure, yeah. Lack of confidence, yes, but it's more than that. It is what I decided was a pretty rational perception of the political system as flawed. So it's not just, we talk a lot about government has lost trust, right? It's lost trust across all age groups and all types of groups, especially since Vietnam and Watergate, right? The trust graph just looked like a kind of a falling lead balloon. But this is beyond that. This is, some really well-meaning and intelligent, bright young people who I thought would be totally wonderful to have in office and who I would rather have represent me than some of the people that, you know, are elected right now. These are people looking pretty rationally at the political system and saying the change that I would like to see in the world would be very hard or maybe even not possible to produce the way that we've set up politics right now.
So I want to ask you in a minute if you think the results of the November election immediately make your book anachronistic. I hate to ask that, but if
well,
you think,
I hope so.
but
or to what extent you think it really is a re-galvanizing moment. But let's start with a caller who has a story to tell along these lines, and it's Arlene in Fairhaven. You're on WNYC. Hi, Arlene.
Brian, thanks so much for taking my call.
Thank you.
A number of years ago, I decided to run for school board in my town. I had no political experience, but I had a real cause, and the cause was that they had stopped teaching grammar in the schools in our town. Sounds crazy, but it's true. And I ran on a grammar platform, and basically bringing back the basics. And I was slandered. I was libeled. My child, who was in sixth grade at the time, was tormented on the playground. He came home in tears one day and said, "Mom, all the kids and their parents say that you want to get rid of recess," which, I mean, obviously, I just wanted kids to learn what a semicolon was. And it was so horrible and so vicious that years later, the town was divided. People had, you know, remembered this campaign of infamy. And I will never, ever even consider doing this again. This was school board.
You know? Oh, boy. But I hope the moral of the story is, hey, everybody else, don't even try.
Well, I mean, I don't know what to say about everybody else. I hope they do try. I sincerely hope they do. I just want to say that you know, having been subjected to the process over such a relatively benign campaign, I honestly, I'm so shell-shocked. I don't know where to go from here. I mean, I'm politically active, but I would never put myself out there. Mm-hmm. Because my family was maligned. You know, it wasn't just me. There was an 11-year-old child involved here.
Mm. That sounds like a horror story. Thank you for sharing it with us. Appreciate you having the courage and fortitude to do that in public after what it sounds like you went through. Professor, go ahead.
What an amazing story, first of all, and I'm so grateful to Arlene that she told us about it and also tried to do something good for her community, and I deeply appreciate the grammar platform. But it is such a perfect illustration of what, and these were people I was talking to who had never run, but I think they were looking ahead and anticipating just such an occasion, and particularly the idea of their families being attacked, turned off both men and women, right? And this was an interesting place I did not see. There were a lot of gender differences, but this was not one of them. Both men and women hated the idea that their family, their spouse, or their kids would then have to be kind of part of the campaign in a negative way. And I don't think, Brian, the solution is just don't run. I mean, that's clearly, I think, the lesson that Arlene took, and that a lot of the young people I talk to are taking. But what I'm hoping is that it's a lesson more for the rest of us, not the candidates, but the rest of us who need to learn that people who put themselves forward for public service, you know, are human beings. And first of all, worthy of some respect, you know, but also have some flaws. That we treat people just awful when they volunteer to be our representatives. It's kind of astounding to me.
And it's funny that she mentioned school board, only because I was going to mention that since the election, I've had a few different liberal guests horrified by Trump who say the first thing you should do after attending a protest is run for school board or community board or something attainable and hyper local like that. And, right. You know, and I think that doesn't necessarily weaken Trump, but is that the advice that you would give to the suddenly highly alienated or motivated?
Maybe, but the first thing to do, I think, is not to run for something until you've gotten involved in local politics in kind of a meaningful way and see what it's about and what it's like and what you would want to run for. You know, I don't recommend everybody just go out and run, but I do think that we have let the grassroots atrophy a little. And in particular, the Tea Party has been far more effective in the last couple of years than the left in kind of really getting its people into the grassroots level of governance. So, I mean, there's just thousands and thousands of positions that are not necessarily elected, but that could lead then to elected office. And maybe with a less, hopefully, a less acrimonious and less vicious campaign if you were already the ward boss or, you know, a party leader, mm-hmm. that you would know people kind of in local government, know what local government can do, and first of all, where you would want to run. And then also people would know you. One of the biggest problems I think we're seeing, and it sounds like Arlene had this problem, is that voters, it sounds like, are just not giving candidates the benefit of the doubt that the candidate's heart is in the right place. And whatever your political position, whatever your party or your policy preferences, my hope is that politics could mean something different than it does right now. Like, a lot of my respondents see politics as old white men shouting at each other, which to me as a political scientist is just heartbreaking, right? That democracy depends on people who are diverse finding a way to compromise. So especially at the grassroots, especially at the town level, if we could find a way to think that politics is the way that we avoid violence. Politics is hopefully good people working together to get something done. And what if Arlene could have gotten the benefit of the doubt to say, I care about grammar because, and she could have explained herself instead of people just jumping on her. I mean, it's just this immediate jump to viciousness, which is so dangerous in a democracy.
My guest is Rutgers Camden professor Shauna Chamez with her new book, Out of the Running, Why Millennials Reject Political Careers and Why It Matters. And Drew in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Drew. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Okay. Thank you.
So I am calling because I am a millennial. I'm 25. I work in local politics. And increasingly over the last 2 years, I'd say, especially with the election, I've been thinking more and more about running. And, you know, Barack Obama said it in his farewell speech to the nation that if you're upset with the state of things, with the status quo, you should grab a clipboard and run. And that's something on my mind for sure. But I am still ambivalent about it. I think your previous call with the school board hit one of my apprehensions about, you know, your name being dragged through the mud and really putting yourself out there very vulnerably in the public. And that may not be good for people around you or just your own self-esteem. And then the other thing for me personally is when the right time is, right? I think I have the energy to do it. I could have the energy to do it now, but maybe not the expertise or the experience necessary, but then if I wait 15, 20 years, then I'm like an old white guy as opposed to someone with energy right now. And then the last thing I think about in New York specifically is being called a carpetbagger. I moved here when I was 18, but I'm not from here, and that's sometimes an issue for certain constituencies.
And if you're not going to run, what are some of the alternatives that you're looking at for yourself for remaining politically active in other ways? I'm just curious.
Sure. So I enjoy my job right now. I don't want to say who I work for, but I'm a liaison for a city politician.
Sure.
And I enjoy working in that field. I'm looking at going to grad school for urban planning to get more involved in the land use side of things because I don't have those hard skills. And I think there's plenty of room behind the scenes, so to speak, to influence a elected official from their office as opposed to directly as an elected official. But I also believe that we're really seeing a trend towards, like, the need for local younger elected officials, like new blood, because I think some of the older Democrats are stuck in kind of a centrist business transaction type way of governing, mm-hmm. whereas the younger people my age might be able to bring more idealism in and really shift the party and the politics to the left, which personally I would like to see. I know probably not everyone agrees with that, but that's how I feel. And I think that would be the difference between me running versus working for someone in their 50s who's also a Democrat nominally.
Well, when you're elected president in 2044, we will go back to this phone call and replay the tape. And go, Drew, that guy, President Drew, he called the show. It was like way back in 2017. Drew, thank you very much.
Of course. Thank you, Brian.
So your book, Professor Shummis, is really about running for office per se. And Drew's an example of somebody who works behind the scenes for an elected official. And there are many ways to work in politics without running for office yourself if you want to avoid all those pitfalls that you identify, like having your name dragged through the mud publicly and everything else. Do you see that as a less viable or less useful option? Or why didn't you focus the book on that as well?
It's a great question. I had a whole lot of people in my interviews tell me that they don't want to be the candidate and that they really want to be the strategist. Like there's a whole lot of people. I also had people tell me they'd like to run an executive agency, right? They don't want to be the head of the EPA or something like that, but not be the candidate themselves. Which is lovely. And we also need people who will staff the bureaucracy. We need people who will staff the campaigns. We need people who will staff the congressional offices. Those are deeply important positions. But ultimately, all of those positions are accountable to elected officials. And in a democracy, the source of accountability, the source of actual will is supposed to be from the vote. So ultimately, we need candidates who are going to be more than the puppets of everybody behind the scenes. And I understand the impulse to not want to be in the public spotlight in the way that Arlene was, or the impulse to feel like maybe I could do more good behind the scenes. I think that's definitely true. But the fact is that we need people in both positions. And if we've got a lot of good people behind the scenes, which, for example, might be the federal bureaucracy right now, we're still going to have politically elected people and then politically appointed people who are appointed by the elected people who are the head of all those agencies. And we're seeing this play out right now in the federal bureaucracy. It's not going great for the long-term employees.
So we've heard from two callers. One has actually been through it. Afraid of their lives and their families' lives being dragged through the mud as a deterrent to running for office. A couple of the other big ones that you mentioned in the book, you said almost 70% of the students you surveyed said that raising money was an unattractive aspect of politics, and that was the most mentioned deterrent. The second most cited reason was that millennials didn't want to pursue a career in politics because of race bias and double standards. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Sure. So let me start with the raising money thing, largely because I think this is so unusual how we do it here in comparison to like almost every other advanced post-industrial democracy. The way that we have individual candidates raise all of their or most of their campaign funds individually, it is like totally weird comparatively, and in some sense a little weird historically, right? This is, I think, a fairly terrible system, because what it means is that the candidate doesn't get to really be just a candidate. Most of all, what they are is fundraiser in chief. And some estimates put, even once you are elected, once you're serving, some congressmen spend up to 70% of their time dialing for dollars. So there's kind of a really, again, what I thought was a rational deterrent effect that happens for young people looking at the system. And they had, two major reactions to it that I detail in the book. One of them is this individual, like, I don't want to have to ask people for money kind of feeling, which I understand because I don't like doing that either.
Everybody hates that. All the politicians hate that.
Like doing that. Surely we are smart enough to come up with a better system than like individual politicians have to go beg for the money they need to buy pizzas for their volunteers. Largely, a lot of that is about the media costs. So maybe we could rein that in. In most other democracies, they have free or subsidized media for political candidates. Mm-hmm. They also have spending ceilings, which I think would be such an important idea here, because our spending is just completely out of control and it's rising rapidly, like exponentially every election cycle. The spending gets worse, which is totally great for campaign consultants, and I think not very good for democracy.
Unlimited campaign spending is freedom of speech. Didn't you know that?
Well,
I don't want to get into it, but that, of course, is Citizens United. But
it is Citizens United. But the Citizens United is particularly saying, not just because it was Buckley v. Valeo that said, right, you know, unlimited spending is freedom of speech.
Yeah, that was the original one.
Incorrectly decided that the next, we exacerbate that incorrect decision by saying corporations are people, right? They are patently not people, right? There's all kinds of differences between corporations and true persons. That so legally, I think that was just incorrectly decided. That, and it's not a really a legal decision. That's a partisan decision that has greatly decreased trust, I think, in the Supreme Court and our government as a whole. But what it means is that young people first don't want to ask people for money, and then secondly, there's this additional factor that I call the ick factor, where they just thought it was icky. Mm-hmm. Even once you've asked, it feels icky to accept it. Right, because then you might be indebted, or you might have to compromise your principles. So it feels like corruption rather than trying to do good for people. Even if that's why you're asking for the money, you still have to accept it, and that compromises you.
Julie, let me go to another call. Julie, yes, in the financial district, you're on WNYC. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Brian. So I come from the private sector. I'm a three-time tech CEO. And my first experience trying to get involved in more public sector work happened when I went to JFK over the last few days to volunteer with the lawyers. Now, I'm not a lawyer. I don't have a legal background. But I was so shocked by the layers of infighting and hierarchy and how little could effectively get done that I don't know that I, as a person who's always worked in the private sector, who is used to moving things quickly because our capital is literally capital, not social capital, I couldn't see myself running for office after witnessing what these NGOs and lawyers were doing, even in the type of work which was clearly critical, which is helping these detainees get through the airport.
What did you see? Because most of the press that these lawyers and other volunteers have gotten has been glowing as, you know, this was the cavalry coming to the rescue when an immigration emergency broke out.
So I actually came to help with the media. I had posted to a group of friends saying that I think that people who are concerned need to get better PR on this because they're labeling some of the issues as progressive issues when I view them as American issues. These detainees are being subject to something that's, in my view and the view of many legal scholars, unconstitutional. And what they insisted on doing was clamping down, not talking to the media in any constructive way, and having very few spokespeople that were able to express the issues in ways that were speaking to normal people, like, say, me, that this is not a progressive cause. This is just something that violates the Constitution. We all agree that this is the law of the land, whether you're a libertarian, a moderate, or a progressive. And I was so baffled by their narrow viewpoint that this was about their NGOs, their progressive cause, and not we're having a violation of the Constitution, and we should do something about that.
So I'm curious for yourself where that leaves you in terms of planning for future involvement in some way.
Well, my plan, I think, is to avoid the apparatus entirely. I also went to the immigration rally at which Chuck Schumer and Gillibrand and every representative I had and didn't know that I had spoke and felt that it was a lecture to progressives. And I think that what President Trump is doing and many of the issues we're fighting is not political. And I think we should get back to big tent politics, if anyone remembers the term, and say that many of these things are not issues for the Democrats or progressives. They're issues for Americans that want to protect a basic way of life, which is pretty simple. And I'd like us to focus on those issues and not trying to reestablish any particular cause.
By the way, did you say you're a millennial and a three-time tech CEO?
Yeah, I started my first company at 21.
You've had a full life. Maybe you're going to be the president in 2044, who we say, hey, Julie called the show way back when. Thank you very much. I really appreciate, even though it was disheartening, your experience and your point of view. Shona Sharma says, we run out of time. I just want to go back to one other thing that you said before in passing, and that is that there were gender differences among the students who you surveyed in terms of what the biggest deterrents were from running for office. What were those?
So there were both gender and then race within gender differences. And in particular, the women were far more likely than men to see the political world as biased against them. And women of color saw this most of all. And I think that's not a surprise, because I think they are correctly perceiving that, even if they may overestimate the biases. But then particularly seeing the 2016 election, where Hillary Clinton gets slammed for every tiny problem and Trump can get away with just about anything. I mean, that's a tremendous gender double standard that, boy, the millennial women in my sample were very aware of. And they also felt more keenly some of the other things, like having to ask for money, right? That's something that the women didn't want to do. Nobody wanted to do it, but the women didn't want to do it more than the men didn't want to do it, right? So in addition to seeing the same costs and feeling them more keenly, women, and then particularly women of color, saw additional costs and most damaging to their political ambition. And unfortunately, I think, like Julie, they did not see as many rewards as men did on the whole to being involved in politics, right? And they were less tolerant of just being involved for their ego, right? They did not want to be involved unless it could make a difference, which I appreciate. And that's who I'd want in office. I'd want Julie. She sounds amazing. She's in the group kind of least likely to run, unfortunately.
Draft Julie. Shona Shamus, Camden Rutgers Camden Professor of Politics, is the author now of Out of the Running, Why Millennials Reject Political Careers and Why It Matters. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
And thanks to all our callers. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, our note to self-host, Manoush Zomorodi, with a new project for you about your online privacy called The Privacy Paradox. Let's see what Manoush has up her sleeve this time. Stay with us.